General point number 13, if my notes are correct, beginning on page 74. As we consider this, we're talking about those exercises, those spiritual activities that teach us personal discipline. We're considering this, each one of these, from two questions. First one, how do we train or how do we teach ourselves or discipline ourselves to do these things? And how does it strengthen or benefit us in terms, since we're strengthening ourselves privately, how is it going to help us when we gather together for worship? This 13th one is called study, which is the discipline of intentional learning. Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 2 and 15, give diligence to being approved by God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And he encourages Timothy also in 1 Timothy 4, verses 12 through 16, to apply himself to study and to meditation. All of these things are going to enhance Timothy's ability to teach. But this is instruction given to a preacher or a teacher. How can we train ourselves or teach ourselves, discipline ourselves to become better Bible students apart from our gathering together? One might answer and say, well, we could use the class material. Just this past, as a matter of fact, it was yesterday, I heard a lesson in which the fellow presenting the lesson pointed out four things. And it is so simple, easy to remember. All four of them begin with W's. The first one is the Word. And he said, begin by just having a daily 5 to 10 minute reading. Discipline yourself to read the Word 5 to 10 minutes per day. Once that has become a habit with you, you'll want to. You'll find yourself sometimes unconsciously wanting to increase the time and attention you give to it. But what it will also serve is give you something to think about during the day, or perhaps during the evening, that might be different from what we're customarily and constantly fretting about during a day's time. But what it will do is begin moving our thinking in spiritual direction and training ourselves to think spiritual thoughts every day. So spend time with it every day. He also pointed out that we discipline ourselves this way with regard to worship as well. Attend every service, you're capable. And then divide in your reasoning, divide each aspect of worship into single activities. Rather than say, oh, I've got to stay focused during worship, instead say, I'm going to stay focused during the singing of this song and put my everything into it. Then when the prayer is being read, I'm going to give my every attention to the prayer. Do each part of it one single stage at a time, and we'll be able to come to appreciate that activity of worship more and further train ourselves to be disciplined in worship. The third thing that he cited was warmth. Be certain to spend time with other disciples both before and after service. Find a disciple with whom you can sit and share in the worship together. And he used the word warmth, I guess, rather loosely, but he was talking about, in a sense, purposefully cultivate fellowship when we come together. And the fourth one that he cited was work. If we find something to do, even if it's a simple activity before or after services that helps another, or if there's something that we can do during worship services, that when we work, we invest ourselves into the activity, it becomes more meaningful to us, we'll be more concerned for its success and outcome. I think that's eminently applicable when it comes to our personal study. If we apply ourselves in that fashion, we look forward to the moments when we can study, when we can open the book and begin to examine it. I have four things listed here, which are sort of a practical step-by-step way to do this. The first one is repetition. Come back to the same subject. And I don't mean stay with the same subject constantly, but keep coming back to it. Go away from it from time to time so that you can think about it, but come to the same subject again and again until you develop confidence in what you know about it. The second one is concentration. You eliminate those kinds of things that are going to distract you. When I first started preaching and doing Bible studies, I would try to get away from the house or away from the family. And the reason was is that there was Coral and over time, four children total. And they enjoyed life and did so loudly. It was a little hard to concentrate, so I would get away. But there were other things at home that would also distract me. The refrigerator wasn't too far from where my desk was. I mean, that's a distraction. There were other things. There would be chores that would be calling out to me that I wouldn't be thinking about if I was at the office. So eliminate those things that would distract you, even if it means to go somewhere else in order to study. Comprehension. Don't move beyond a particular text until you grasp it. It's easy for us to say, well, I don't get this, and I don't get that, and maybe I'll get this, and by the time we're done, we've picked up very little of it. It's kind of like climbing over rocks. You can't go as travel as fast climbing over rocks as you can running on track. So don't expect to make time or a great deal of progress when you're wrestling with something difficult. Take your time to methodically work your way through each one of those. What you'll discover is that the Bible writers wrote in the same way we converse. They were building one thought upon another until you come to a reasonable conclusion. And that's why it's important to get those thoughts along the way so that the conclusion's not lost. Fourth, reflection. After you study, you'll spend time thinking about it. You can take a walk. You can work in the garden. You can mow the lawn. You can paint the garage. Do something that occupies your hand but not your mind. And that will give you time to think on the things. Reflect on them. Those kinds of times is when you get the insights as to how to apply what you've learned. Studying may be just grasping the abstract. But when we're thinking about it and reflecting on it, that's whenever we get those little insights and those aha moments where we see how to apply and practice those things. What we find is that the more we know the Word, the more we come to appreciate the worship that we engage in based upon the Word. 14, simplicity. Freedom from anxiety about things and fear of others' opinions. Well, you can put any number of list of things in here. It is not coming to the place where we don't care what others think, but that we're not going to be anxious about what others think and say. I recall studying with one sister a number of years ago. In fact, it's been more than 20 years ago now that I think of it. But at any rate, she was concerned. She had a moral dilemma, and both the choices that were before her were good moral choices. But she couldn't pick either one. And when asked why she couldn't choose either one, it's because if I do this, someone will think I'm doing it for that reason, and if I do that, someone else will question my motives. Why worry about what others are going to think or say if you're doing the good and right thing? Simplicity is the approach to moral choices, where we sort of boil it down and take out the sediment, and all we're left with is what the Lord has told us and our desire to fulfill it. And we do not overly concern ourselves about what others may think or say about our choice. 15 is service.
That's such a hard thing to do.
Oh, absolutely.
The simplicity or what we want to be pleasing, but sometimes our decisions are not going to be what everybody wants, but there's been so many sleepless nights because of this. It's a tough thing to get through.
And sometimes the things that we're worried about never come to pass, or the likelihood of them coming to pass is low. Or if they do come to pass, it wasn't because of the choice we made. We can't control what others are going to think, say, or feel about us, especially when we're doing the right thing. We can't control it. And so choose to do the right thing, and at the same time, this is where we're disciplining ourselves not to allow fear or concern over what someone else may say or do impede our doing what is right.
there's a, sometimes we develop a habit of doing this. And if we're not worried about something, we'll invent something to worry about because it's something I've always done. I mean, that's hard to let go of these things.
Yeah. We're instructed not only by the Apostle Paul, but Peter addresses it briefly in his epistle about this fear and anxiety thing. I'm not saying is it real, and I'm not poking fun at each other when we have those issues, but it's something that we can overcome, something that we're instructed to overcome. Perhaps sometimes if we laugh at our monsters, we'll find something funny about our monsters, maybe they won't seem so terrifying. You know, the story was told of a gospel preacher who was traveling someplace for a meeting, and he heard that there would be terrible storms. And when he arrived there, he was wringing his hands, and the brother who was picking him up at the train says, "What's troubling you so much?" He says, "Oh, there's going to be a lot of storms, and people might get hurt, or they might die on the way to the gospel meeting." And the fellow says, "Well, calm down. You know, folks may choose to stay home because of the storm." He said, "Well, then the meeting's going to be unsuccessful, and I'm troubled and threatened about that, too." And the fellow says, "Well, calm down. It'll work out." He says, "Well, I'm trying to, but there's just so many things to worry about." And the man says, "Preacher, don't you realize that worrying like that is a sin?" And the preacher said, "Yes, that's what worries me the most." We can fret ourselves out of doing what's right. Sometimes if we just step back a little bit and see that which we were afraid of is silly. In fact, I would suggest it's a good exercise, training exercise in this simplicity thing. Might be to think back on times when we were worrying about other things and they didn't come to pass. Okay. Service, the discipline of doing things for someone other than self. This is a good challenge. It can be put to an extreme, and I'll say something about that in a moment. But this matter of service, where we actually make the choice to do something for someone, especially when it carries us out of our comfort zone or costs us something that we would like to have held on to, that's a challenge. But when we discipline ourselves to do just that, on a very, very small scale, we've tasted what our Lord tasted on our behalf. Thus, we continue to train ourselves to think this way and to do this way, and it isn't long until we're living more and more like our Savior. Now, there are those who might carry this too far and insist on being the only ones who serve, or the one who will be served only. I will only do service. I will never let anybody wait or serve me. And that's carrying it to an extreme. Because sometimes allowing another to perform a service for us is doing them a spiritual benefit, giving them an opportunity to learn to be, or to discipline themselves to be of service to others.
Paul, to add that, when you're so focused on yourself, especially during times of depression, that's all you think about is what's going on with me, and it's hard to crawl out of that well, but if you can start, like you say here, doing things for someone else, finally it takes the focus off yourself and you can kind of look outward then and not so much about yourself. And the depression times will ease away if you can focus on others and start doing for others.
Well, and that's one of the ways that we bootstrap ourselves out of the blue spirit. Is that if while we're focused on all the things that's worrying me and troubling me and it's just, I can't fix what's going on with me right now. But guess what I can do? I might be able to go over and help somebody else. Now, two things happen. I go over and I help someone else and I forget momentarily about my own issues. And then after it's over with, I get a mental health thing, I get the vicarious experience of having helped someone overcome. It is as if I've overcome myself. And it will teach me patience and wait for when my issue will be overcome later. So it is dual benefit to the person who's practicing it, not just for the person at the receiving end. The last one Secondly, submission. Submission is the discipline, and I listen to the way this is worded, the discipline of freeing yourself from the obsession of getting your own way. One of the hardest things in the world is to have a good idea, or what you believe to be a better idea, or the best idea, only to discover that many of the others want to do it a different way. It's hard to sit back and say, okay, let's go ahead and do it that way, and enthusiastically support that effort. It's very difficult. I think that those who have had the blessing and privilege of serving as elders understand this, because you're working with other men who are different from yourself. And you have come to the place where you practice yielding to one another to the point that it's almost second nature. It is a manifestation of maturity when we can accomplish this. Now, how will this translate into benefiting us in worship? We don't always get to do the leading. We don't always get to do the teaching or the praying or the singing or something like that. But we can enthusiastically support those. He may have chosen a song I don't care for, but I will enthusiastically support his leadership in that song and submit to his choice in the matter. I may not particularly care for the sermon subject that he's chosen, but what I'm going to do is listen to him and encourage him for having proclaimed the message after it's over with. And I'll sit there as Brother Raymond Williams used to say when I preached, I'll wrestle with the word and come away learning something. Discipline ourselves to be in service. Discipline ourselves to be subject. And these may be the hardest things of all in the training. That's probably why I put them near the end. Any discussion about these before moving on? Okay. The importance of spiritual discipline is seen in the life that is undisciplined. When we look at the undisciplined life, and I know this is approaching it from a negative perspective, but when you look at the undisciplined life, you can see how blessed the state of one is who leads a spiritually disciplined life. An undisciplined life leads to, one, a lack of restraint that produces indulgence in carnal desires. If we don't discipline ourselves with regard to any activity, we find ourselves more willing to engage in activities that might be self-destructive or harmful long-term. The same thing is true with our spiritual lives. If we don't restrain ourselves in some moral issues, it'll be like a gateway drug into some other more severe moral violations. Number two, a lack of respect for authority that may eventually produce a departure from God's will. An undisciplined life does not regard authority. In fact, an undisciplined life is inherently opposed to authority. Quite often, the undisciplined life is proud of being undisciplined, claiming to be happy in their undisciplined state. Authority threatens that undisciplined life and that undisciplined state. And so authority is resented. It isn't long before you see number three, an overt defensiveness about sinful choices and lifestyles. You will see a decline in spiritual and in some cases physical health if the sin that is engaged in has an impact on the body. You see harm coming to financial future, rising debt and things of that nature if the undisciplined life engages in activities that are morally reprehensible and financially stupid. Poor performance at work, failure to advance, job loss. Undisciplined life spiritually is going to flow over, that mentality and spirit is going to flow over into other parts of one's life. Development of slothful habits, in some cases an unkempt appearance, reckless manner of speech, declining social skills, usually due to the lack of someone or regard for the well-being and the rights of others. These can lead to the loss of relationships. Habitual tardiness, procrastination, undependability, waste of time and resources, eventually blaming others or circumstances, loss of influence and credibility, and complete inability to be a faithful and effective Christian. An undisciplined life compromises a believer's testimony for Christ. Now, all of these things are sort of end-stage matters. But it's what it leads to. Therefore, a disciplined life won't guarantee these won't happen, but will greatly reduce their likelihood. In fact, disciplining our lives spiritually will enable us to overcome these things, especially the temptations to yield to them. Any discussion about this section, Steve?
And it's so important for the family to teach discipline, to teach responsibility in the home, that's a natural progression to obey God and be responsible and obedient to God the Father if the child is obedient to the Father in a home, at the home. It just makes a natural bridge, a natural progression that you're in the habit of submitting to authority. Well, it's just a natural thing to do when we learn of God.
Exactly. In fact, I think that the will to be subject to authority is more effective and pure when we first learn subjection to God. We recognize that God has invested authority in others. Our parents has invested authority in our teachers, invested authority in elders and civil leaders and so forth. So since if we begin with respecting God's authority, we will respect those that God has given authority as well. Realizing that, and it's like the apostle told those who are employees and servants, to have regard and work for your employer as unto the Lord, because the Lord is the one who gave them the authority. Very good point. Now, having looked at the negative, let's get a little more positive, because that was uncomfortable. What is required for spiritual self-discipline? You may see that some of these things are carryovers from what you might see in secular life. I would say that those who use these things in secular upbuilding courses borrow them from the Scriptures. If you go over to page 76, these are the sources for some of this material. Disciplines for Disciples by Mark Copeland, Celebration of Discipline, the Path of Spiritual Growth by Foster, and Self-Discipline, the Pillar of Christian Character by John MacArthur. So most of this section isn't original with me. But I like this part. What is required for spiritual self-discipline? Having definite purpose. Know where you're going and what you intend to do. If someone wants to become a Bible class teacher for the high school and college level kids, he has a goal in mind. He's going to then look for the steps that enable him to get to that goal. He's not going to go through life hoping someday somebody invites him to teach at the teenager high school class. He'll prepare for it. Goals will clarify what disciplines we need. How much study I'm going to need to do in order to teach a high school class. Detach from things that distract from our goals. Separate from them. Now, I'm not talking about those necessary things in our lives and those things about this world and this life that we enjoy rightfully as Christians. Our families, our occupations, our community, our recreation. I'm not saying detach from those things, but I'm talking about the kinds of things that would keep us from meeting our spiritual goals. Now, our spiritual goal in this study is to become more disciplined in our worship of God. So what we would do is eliminate those things or separate ourselves from those things that would keep us from assembling as well as keep us from focusing when we're worshiping. C. Pursue objectives with diligence. You've heard the term yo-yo dieting. You know, you diet for a week or two and then you're off, and then you diet for a couple of weeks or a month and you're off. That kind of thing is not healthy. I'm given to understand. Well, understand this. That if we don't apply ourselves diligently to our goals, we're never going to be achieved. We're never going to realize them. Reflecting on the worthiness of goal will increase focus on the course. If ever remembering why we're doing something, sit down and try to remember why it was we chose to do it in the first place. If the motivations were worthy then, they continue to be worthy today. Be consistent. The full benefits of a self-controlled life can be found only through regular practice. Stay with it diligently. Even when tempted not to. In fact, when tempted not to do it is exactly the time that you need to engage it. Practice self-control. Stumbling happens. Get up and return to work. I'm not suggesting you're never going to make a mistake, but don't let me be in the world and give up. Instead, say, okay, I made a mistake. I'm going to get back into the practice or back into the discipline. Say no both to the heart and in the heart and with the mouth with conviction to all temptation to ease up or take a break. Quite often, if we ease up or take a break on doing what we know is right, it isn't long until that break is extended. And then that goal is rationalized to be set aside for a time, and then the goal is forgotten. Remember accountability, not just accountability to God, but the impact and influence on others and the self. Write it down and read it often. That's it. Sit down and write down what will be the impact on yourself and the impact on others if I fail to maintain my discipline in this worthy goal. Now let's look at the rewards. What comes to us out of a disciplined life? First, a more orderly and consequently less stressful life. We cannot control those stressors that come from the outside. We're going to encounter stressors such as are imposed on us by the civil government. You get a letter in the mail and it comes from the U.S. Department of Treasury and they say, you did your taxes wrong. That's a stressor. You can't control that. But there are some things that stress us that we can control. And we can also control the level of stress that we allow such things to upset us. Can I fix this today? No. Then I'm going to set it aside until I can fix this, whatever the issue may be. Self-discipline can increase peace, joy, and confidence. Have you ever met someone when there was a lot of things up in the air and it just seemed like a storm swirling around? I'm not talking about literally, but among folks. And there's one person who's calm in the middle of it. No, it's not someone who's drunk or on drugs. It's someone who has confidence that this too will pass and we'll get to where we need to be. That's someone who is leading a disciplined life. Second, it brings improved confidence and self-esteem. In fact, you find someone that once they successfully meet a goal are eager to find more and sometimes more difficult goals and set them. They do so because of the confidence they had in successfully reaching the first goal. An increased productivity. There are some people, we ask ourselves the question, how in the world do they get that many things done in a day? And it's not because they have higher levels of energy. It's not because they're stronger or whatever we want to assign to it. It's persons who have found a way to structure their lives and do so in such a way that they enjoy the peace of moving from one place to the next during the day and getting things accomplished. A well-planned day is generally more fruitful. Next one, better health. Again, all of these things are going to spread out to other aspects of our lives, but in this particular case, we're talking about a physical health in which we discipline ourselves and again overcome those things that hinder our service and increase our capacity to accomplish good works in the Lord's service. This, of course, takes into account the limitations of life. I can't do the things today that 15 years ago I could do. But that's what's going to come to all of us. But if we're careful, we'll be able to maintain our strength and our energy and accomplish good things. Letter E, sound, healthy impact and influence on others. A disciplined life is a life that has powerful influence on other people. We find them attracted to that kind of life. In some cases, interested in it. They may be inspired to do the same. It can lead us to opportunities to teach others about self-discipline in our lives. And the last one, and the most significant one, is that of eternal reward. The Apostle Paul acknowledges that he disciplines himself and keeps his body subject to himself, so that after preaching to others, he might not be a castaway. Paul recognized the importance of controlling his life. Paul told Timothy, spiritual exercise is beneficial in all aspects of your lives. And so this is the principle of training ourselves. And the last one, how can self-discipline be applied in worship? I think at this point, after going over all these things, it makes sense to us and really doesn't need a lot of explanation. But if in our private moments and private lives we find discipline and train ourselves to remain in control, that's going to translate into our worship. But the truth is that we're doing this in our private lives so that when we come together in the presence of the Lord, the one whom we wish to glorify when we assemble together, we can do it to our utmost. In other words, disciplining ourselves in our home lives is not going to have the subsidiary effect of making our worship better. It's the reason why we discipline ourselves at home, so that our worship will be more glory, give more glory to the Father in heaven. My notes say it should be fairly obvious at this point that if the principles of self-discipline above are adopted and applied by the Christian, he or she will use them in worship as well as in all aspects of life. The things that enhance our focus when alone or in a secular setting will work equally well when assembled for worship. In fact, fellowship with others should facilitate self-control and awareness when gathered together in the presence of the Lord. Thank you for your patience in letting me complete this material this evening. I want to encourage you to do questions on your own. I know I put a number of them in there, and that can be for you to discipline yourselves to review this lesson. Let's put it aside. I want to introduce the next class. You received a copy of the new class book, Revelation of Jesus Christ, and I've entitled the work The Triumph of the Suffering Church, because that's essentially what Revelation is discussing. It is talking about the triumph of the church, facing the obstacles and the adversaries that they had to deal with there in the first century. I would really encourage you to read the foreword that I put in, that starts on page 1, because that is an explanation of how this study developed. When Paul and I were first married, we lived in Tampa. In fact, we lived near Temple Terrace. And we assembled with the congregation at first Sulphur Springs, and then Sulphur Springs merged with Castle Heights, which became Master Avenue. I worked with Brother Almond Williams for about 4 years. In 81, Brother Williams was asked to teach Revelation. And I guess he was kind of busy, and he said to me, "Why don't you do it?" Now, I am a 21-year-old kid, and I had not taught the adult Bible class before. And Almond grabs me and throws me into the deep end of the pool. And since it was a book of Revelation, he tied a concrete block around my ankle, because I thought I was going to drown. Well, I asked for some time to prepare that class, but about 8 or 9 months. And read dozens of books to get ready for it. And produced notes for the class, and have taught this a number of times since then. This will make my 7th time for going through the book of Revelation. Each time I've gone through it, I've revised the book. this will be the last time. If I get my nerve up, and when this study is complete, and I've had a chance to review everything that's here, and they send it off to publication, I tell them no. But at any rate, I included a list of resources that I've used over the years. And if you turn the page, you will see beginning 2/3 of the way down through page 2, going all the way in page 3, the books and resources that I have used over the years to research this. I'm going to say at the outset that I take an approach to the book of Revelation that may not be the most common or the most popular among brethren. Honorable, highly respected by me, Bible teachers and Bible students have written a number of things over the years with regard to it. Many of them take the late date Rome-centric view. And what that means, I know that it may not mean a whole lot this moment, but it will come to mean something as the study unfolds. The late date Rome-centric view states that John wrote the book somewhere between the dates of 90 AD to possibly 94, could be as late as 96, and he makes Rome the central city that is rebuked in the book. I take the early date approach, that the book had to have been written before the siege against the city of Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem is the city that is rebuked in this book. And the reason I came to that conclusion is the longer I studied the subject and read the things that brethren had written, the harder it was for me to put the square book of Revelation in the round hole of the late date. It just didn't seem to fit. And so I've developed what will begin in introductory lesson on page 7, a rather long defense of that position. Regardless of whether one takes the early date Jerusalem-centric view or the late date Rome-centric view, it has no impact on the message, because the message is God's people are going to triumph. It has no impact on it. Basically, the only thing it does is give a variation and an explanation of some of the symbols, none of which are applicable to our present time. We also, as disciples of the Lord, take what I call a modified preterist view. And I know these are big words I'm throwing out, but let me explain it. The pure preterist view says that everything in the book of Revelation has already taken place. We take a modified view, and that is that much of what's in the book of Revelation has already taken place, with the exception of the end time prophecies that you see in the last 2 or 3 chapters. And those things have yet to come to pass. We will talk about those, and I assure you that I am in full agreement with what the brethren have written about those. But remember, this study is about the triumph of the church over its enemies in the first century. And that's the message. And it will not be changed whether we do early or late date, or Jerusalem or Rome centric view. It's just I'm more comfortable with the early date. I would be happy to talk with you about that more privately, but I really don't want to spend a lot of time in our Bible class debating both viewpoints, because that will serve no purpose. It will take us away from what the book means. The book of Revelation is the only what is considered full book of prophecy in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, you have multiple books of prophecy. You have a number of books of short ones that were written by what we sometimes call minor prophets, and we have 5 books called major prophets, as well as you have other prophets who delivered prophecies during in the books of history in the Old Testament. Those prophets were prolific in talking about what was to come. But the book of Revelation is pretty much the only book in the New Testament that appears to be devoted to prophecy. Now we need to understand as we study this book that the Bible is self-consistent. that the elements used in prophecy in the Bible, whether Old or New Testament, are going to be consistent with one another. Please understand that we're not going to interpret locusts as helicopters or gunships. We're not going to interpret plagues as being HIV. We're just not going to play those games. We're going to look at those prophecies the way Bible prophets used them, which is why much of the introductory material is dedicated to looking at how those prophetic symbols were used in the past, and that becomes a key to understanding them in the book of Revelation. I was reluctant at first, but now I'm looking forward to studying this with you, and I commend you to really applying yourself to understanding this book of prophecy.